Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Hang in there,
dude,
it is.
That's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show. What's up, y'all? Really excited to share this conversation with you. My guest today is the 10th ranked player in the world, the reigning U.S. Open champion, and boarding a flight to Rome shortly to play in his first Ryder Cup for Team USA, Wyndham Clark. I walked with Wyndham in the final round of the U.S. Open, really enjoyed recapping some of the best shots he hit. We also went on an entertaining tangent discussing some of our best club tosses and breaks. So let's get right to it. Here's my chat with Wyndham Clark. All right, guys, we got Wyndham Clark joining the Smiley Show. Wells Fargo champion, U.S. Open champion, and now on the Ryder Cup team for the USA. And Wyndham, we're going to get into all that, but, you know, we typically, all of these guys that come on, we kind of go back to where it all began. And for you, you know, you and I played a bunch of junior golf together, some amateur golf, but really being from Denver, Colorado, you know, that's an unusual place for a tour player to come from, because what's your seasons look like growing up?
Well, it depends on how motivated you are as a golfer. So if
that's
you,
a good point.
If you're your weekend golfer, you probably have, you know, 5-6 months. I was, you know, obsessed with the game. So I probably got 9 to 10 months on grass. And then, and when I mean on grass, like there's some days where the ground was frozen, but I was hitting off of grass, but you know, it wasn't like actually good grass. And then there's probably a month where I didn't play golf. And then there was a month where I was kind of doing indoor. So I was like 9 to 10 months realistically. But that was like crazy. I'd be out there when it's 25 degrees, bundled up, but it wasn't windy. I'd shovel off some snow and you're hitting balls.
I heard a story about you. I was at the U.S. Amateur at Cherry Hills, which I'm sure you tuned into. But yep. one of the members came up to me and told me a story about you at around 12 or 13 years old, and said that you got onto the 17th green and two with a famous 17th hole with the island green. But they said you hit it on a two at like such a young age, and it was like cold out that day that like everybody knows that you did that. Do you remember that at all, or is that just like this folktale?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I probably did do that, but I don't know. It's one of those where to me it just was a good it's a good shot, and you're like, okay, sweet, right. And you're worried if you made the eagle putt. And then to the members, they probably maybe went off and told. So maybe it's a little folklore or not. But what I will say is at a young age, I was getting on that green and two.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. You're one of the longest players on the PGA Tour. But, I mean, you were kind of talking about the seasons of, you know, only getting to really play 8 or 9 months out of the year in Denver. And I'm pretty certain you were an athlete growing up in high school, correct? You were playing multiple sports?
Yeah. Yep. I played basketball a couple of years in high school. Obviously I played everything leading up to high school, and then I just focused on basketball and golf.
Yeah, and so you're kind of built like a cornerback in the NFL. I mean, was there any way you were not going to be a golfer? Like, was there any other sport that you were so into that you felt like you know, I'm going to keep going at this, but really, like, when did golf become the focal point for you?
Well, I would say this is probably pretty common for most people. Most kids that love sports, is depending on the season, that was the sport you wanted to be professional in. So growing up in the fall, I wanted to be Peyton Manning or Tom Brady. And then, then I get into the basketball season, I wanted to be Kobe Bryant. And then you get into, you know, the hockey, baseball, and, you know, you wanted to be that. And then I get into summer and I wanted to be Tiger Woods. So that was that cycle all the way through to probably eighth grade. And then it just mainly became basketball and golf. And if you asked me my freshman year, I probably still wanted to be a basketball player. I loved basketball and I thought I could be good. I started by the end of the midway through the year. I started, on our varsity team, my freshman year.
Wow.
And we were pretty good. We made that year to the, I think we lost in the round of eight in state. And so we were good. But it was funny, and this is why I bring this up, is at the end of my basketball season, and I had zero college golf or zero offers to any school. I mean, I was a late bloomer. I was 5'6" at the time, you know, I was 5'7", maybe I was short. And then by the end of my freshman year of golf, I had letters from all the schools. And then I played another season and I grew a little bit. And the same thing happened. Zero letters in basketball, but want every school was knocking at my door. And my dad was like, so do you want to keep, you know, you still wanting to play basketball? And he kept asking me. And I'm like, why are you asking? He's like, oh, I'm just curious. You know, I mean, you're getting a lot of looks in golf and whatever. And basically he was saying, he's like, I think you should stop playing basketball and focus on golf. So I tried to stick with it as long as possible. I love basketball, but, you know, ending up at right around 6 feet and not having, you know, not being able to dunk and whatnot, that doesn't go too far in basketball, but it works well in golf. So I'd say kind of around my sophomore year is when I really was like, all right, golf's the sport for me.
Yeah, I mean, basketball and golf are both my love for sports. I would have loved to play in the NBA, but like you, I quickly realized that I probably need to keep playing golf because just didn't quite have it at the basketball level. But, You know, I think it's kind of fascinating. I think a lot of people get interested in like just college recruitment, especially how different it is now. But when we were coming up, you know, letters like you're talking about, you know, being from Denver, how did you kind of settle in on Oklahoma State? Like, what were the other schools you were looking at? Were you kind of looking around you or everywhere? What, you know, what was the thing that got you to Oklahoma State?
Well, I kind of had some, we had some good players that came before me that their parents kind of gave us some advice. And that was guys like Drew Stoltz, his parents, by the way, not a good player, but just went to college, played college golf. So we can give him trash that, but his dad helped my dad out. I don't know if you remember Steve Ziegler. He went to Stanford. Mm-hmm. And then like the Schoolcraft boys, they both went and played at top schools. And then
Oklahoma, right?
When was Oklahoma? Oklahoma for Mike, and Bo went to UCLA.
Okay.
And then Mark, Gunnar Wiebe. And so, and then actually Matt Scovey, who played at SMU. So those guys were all really close, kind of guys I looked up to. They were about anywhere from 2 to 4 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And they were going through all that. And then they went, and my dad was picking their brain, like, okay, how does your son like it? And basically after hearing that, I quickly learned that I didn't really want to go to the California schools because I just heard how much of a nightmare it was to go, you know, go to practice and to get to practice every day and always stuck in traffic and all that. And I was like, yeah, I don't want that. and then, you know, then to go to the way south, like Florida and, you know, and places like LSU and Alabama, that's just so far from home.
Yeah.
And so I kind of didn't really look as much into that. And so it really came down to like kind of the Midwest, and Oregon. So I really liked Casey Martin. My dad and I loved Casey Martin, in college, but I just didn't feel like compared to Oklahoma State and Texas, I just feel like they weren't quite there. I mean, granted,
right.
this was, 11, no, more than that. Yeah. 11, 12 years ago. I just feel like their program wasn't where those other programs were. And so I really came down to Oklahoma State and Texas. And the main thing for me was the coach and the facilities. And then obviously the players that have, that came from those schools. And, you know, prior to, you know, the recent success that Texas has had, I kind of looked at it and was like, okay, they had some top players. But I just felt like Oklahoma State, you know, every year was a pipeline for the best players.
Right.
I
love definitely Mike was.
Obviously now Texas has, you know, Coach Fields done a great job from Scheffler to Spieth and Bo Hostler and all these, you know, great players on tour. But prior to that, I just felt like Oklahoma State was a spot and, you know, totally two different places and way different than Colorado, but I just felt like it was a place for me. And I said, I wanted to be a professional golfer. And I said, this is the place that produces the most professional golfers. So I said, that's where I want to go. So that's kind of what it really came down to.
Well, that's really interesting. I'm trying to picture you as a Texas Longhorn. I just don't really see you in any burnt orange clothes. But, you know, when you were at Oklahoma State, you decided to transfer and you kind of talked about Casey Martin and just like how comfortable you felt with him and knowing that they weren't quite there, but still you kind of mentioned that the other two schools didn't really feel like home. And being from Denver, Colorado, going to Eugene, Oregon, was there any feeling of home between Denver and Eugene? I've been to Eugene. It's to me feels way more like Denver than Oklahoma State would feel like Denver.
You know, I don't know if that's necessarily correct. I mean, it does feel like, don't get me wrong, pine trees, rivers and mountains. Yes, it does feel more like that. I never had the intentions of going to University of Oregon. I mean, truthfully, I never wanted to. I bled orange. I love Oklahoma State. And just kind of as things happened in my life and I kind of needed a fresh start, I really did it more for my career and for my head to be like, hey, I need a fresh start. I need to go somewhere that's going to help me succeed, and it has nothing to do with Oklahoma State being a bad place. I just had so much turmoil there. And so I just wanted something new. And I thought Casey Martin, the great things he did with Aaron Wise to get to the PGA Tour. And then obviously their team winning the national championship the year before I got there. I was like, okay, well I'm really interested in that. You know, and then it ended up being one of the best decisions of my life because I did have that freedom and I did have that fresh start. No one on the team knew about my history. They didn't know about anything that happened to my mom and all the issues I was having off the golf course. And so when I showed up, all they knew was me. And so just that in itself was huge. And then, you know, then Casey, Casey made me feel just so much freedom that like, hey, you're our best player. I trust you. Continue to work on your game because you have a year and a half to get ready for Q school. That's pretty much what he told me. He goes, you have a year and a half to get ready for Q school. And I'm going to help you as much as possible to try to get you ready and prepare you for professional golf. And he goes, in the meantime, I want you to play great golf, but also know, he goes, I also know that you have long-term expectations and goals. And he's like, I want to help you for that. And not many coaches would have done that. They'd have been like, hey, I want you to be like focus here and now, which granted I was, don't get me wrong. I was, but he just had that. He just knew. He was like, hey, I know you want to play at the next level. I know you have the ability to. And so he just kind of harnessed that and really focused my energy. And I ended up having a great time. So as far as, you know, feeling at home, I just would say the atmosphere made me feel really comfortable and wasn't that crazy of a change versus if I went, you know, I was really interested in going to Illinois as well. When I transferred, that probably would have been a totally different vibe. So
what was your first impressions of your caddy now, John Ellis, who was the assistant coach at Oregon?
Well, what's funny is I didn't know anything about John until I met him. And so when we first met him, I was just like, oh, this is just some, you know, random assistant. They couldn't make it on the Jicky Jacks. So he's probably, not that good of a player. And, you know, so that's kind of what I really thought about him. And then as we would play our first few qualifyings, he would play with our team. And Casey was really like, hey, I want you to play with the team. Obviously, you're still really good. And so did Casey. And both those guys literally beat us like every qualifying.
That has to be so frustrating.
Yeah, well, then the worst part is John's such a trash talker and loves to, you know, give guys shit. And he would say, he's like, if you can't beat me, you have no chance of playing at the next level. Because look at me, I couldn't even make it. And so, you know, in my mind, I was like, well, dang, he's kind of right. So I got to get a lot better. And he was my barometer, I'll be honest. I was like, okay, if this guy can't make it, who I think is really good and everyone says how good he is, and Casey can't make it, and these guys are beating me, then how am I going to make it? And I remember this so vividly. In the fall, I couldn't beat John. I mean, I would shoot 68 at Eugene Country Club, come in all excited, and he shot 66. I'd shoot, you know, 70 at some place on a tough day, and he'd shoot 67. And I'm like, gosh, dang, I can't beat this guy. So then fast forward as we get into the spring and going in later into the spring, then every day I'd come in and shoot 64 and he'd shoot 67. And I started beating him, and that's when I really started winning in college. And then honestly, he helped me so much. John did so much even just in college. And it was just, a lot of it was just playing against me. And talking trash and being like, you're not as good as you think. And he made me a lot better in that way. So, but you know, I think the best of John
is the best. Is it true that John's an extremely fiery player as well?
Oh my gosh. Everyone jokes when he was first on my bag, you know, guys that knew him, let's say anywhere from the ages of like, you know, 34, 35 to about 45, everyone knows John on tour, caddies and players. And he would be caddying my group and I'd hit a bad shot and he'd be like, oh no, it's okay. We can get that up and down. Don't worry. You know, he'd be so positive and he'd be like, you know, I'd be hitting bad all day. And he's like, no, it's totally fine. All we got to just keep giving ourselves chances. We're going to make putts. We're going to do this and this and this. And the guys go, who the hell is this guy? This guy used to be mother effing himself and, you know, literally was the most self-deprecator. And they're like, what happened to John Ellis? So all of them were like, if you did this to yourself, you would be on the PGA Tour. And so I remember hearing a lot of that. So John is so positive in caddying for me, and he hits one bad shot when he plays and it's like the end of the world, breaking clubs, wants to walk off the golf course. So couldn't be polar opposite from what he is caddying.
I mean, would you describe yourself as a fiery player as well? Like, especially in like college, when were you struggling with controlling your emotions?
Oh yeah. I mean, that's part of why I needed that fresh start, going to Oregon. You know, I had a lot of turmoil and, you know, I had a great freshman year, and played some good golf, but then I had two awful years of golf. And I mean,
right.
I'm sure there's a lot of great stories that you have and guys have. Mm-hmm. I'm walking off courses or slamming clubs or whatever it is. And, you know, so John and I would say that we see a lot. I think he sees a lot of, or saw a lot of himself in me saying, hey, John was an All-American. He was really good at Oregon. And he never got out of his own way. And I think he saw that in me and was like, don't make the same mistakes I made. Seriously, like, I know it's easy. You want to get mad at yourself. You know you're better. You're not playing the potential you want to play. Too, but you cannot beat yourself up. You talking to yourself like that, you're going to end up like me. And that's honestly was one of my fears. It's nothing against John. John's an amazing man and has a great life and family. And I just didn't want to be the guy that had all the talent and then didn't make it. And so that's always been one of my fears. And so that's what's been great with John, is he's kind of helped guide me in the direction that we've gone to now, where he's like, you know, just basically he's like, just don't do anything that I did, do the opposite. And so, which has been great, because I have someone on my bag that was so close to making it and knows why he didn't make it. And so he can really coach me, as opposed to some caddies are either just some guy's friends or just some random guy. I have kind of the best of both worlds. I have a great caddy and a great player and a great friend on the bag. So it's a great, great duo.
I love your caddy, John. He's the man. And you don't feel obligated to answer this, but do you have a favorite club toss moment in your PGA Tour career that you'd like to speak about?
Like club throw, you make it sound so nice with a toss.
I teed it up as a toss, but I would like to hear about the throw if you got one.
I got a lot of them.
Any end up in a penalty area?
Yeah. I'm sure you asked people for some advice or some,
honestly, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I have no idea the answer. Nothing came to my head.
I have two good ones. Actually, I have a lot of good ones. Jeez Louise. All right. I'll just run through them. This will be great for the show. So early in my career, I had one at the Amex I was playing awesome. I was literally in contention. And I probably should have had the best finish of my career thus far in that tournament. And it was almost like it was part of my backswing. Or sorry, part of my follow through. We bomb it. You've played the course, right?
Which is it the championship course?
The stadium course.
Yeah.
The par five on the front number, like 4 or 5. And it has the double
dog leg.
Oh, God,
the double dog leg. Oh, God.
Double dog leg. I pound one where I have a 9-iron in. I pound it over. Literally hit it in the water, and as it's in the air, slam, break, throw in the water. It was almost like I didn't even know what happened. And then I was like, and John got so mad at me. He's like, Doug, we're on the fifth hole of the round. Like, we're in contention. What the are you doing? And I was so mad. And then obviously I apologized after. I was like, dude, I don't know what happened. I just blacked out and I broke the club and threw it in the water. So that was a bad one. I had one recently. I'm not going to say exactly when, but I recently broke a putter kind of on accident, kind of on purpose. It was at Sea Island and I was using a lab putter and you know, the big lab putter.
Oh yeah.
And I was hitting it really good and I missed two short putts it was on the seventh hole of the tournament, just started the tournament. And I'm walking off the green and I kind of do a slam. Like I wasn't trying to break the putter, but I was like mad, fully break the putter, seventh hole of the tournament. It wouldn't have broken on a normal putter. This is why it was not 100% my fault. The lab putters, because of the technology, the shaft is not like metal. And so it's plastic. So the thing splinters. And I finished the round with putting with a wedge and a 3-wood, shoot one over. And then I ended up finishing top 10 in the tournament. And I remember John, we walked off at Sea Island. We walked off when we finished top 10 and he literally like pointed at me. He said, you should have won this tournament, but your attitude cost you. And he kind of like got in my face. He said, you know, he basically was calling me a dumbass. He's like, you literally cost yourself a tournament because you lost your head and bent a putt, you know, broke your putter. So,
wow.
Pretty crazy story. But yes, I have tons. I could go actually almost every year I have a club throw or a putter toss or something.
Would it shock you if I beat you? Like, would you be surprised if I beat you on the seventh hole of a golf tournament? Because I did. I snapped a 9-iron on my knee at Houston on the second hole of the golf tournament.
Oh my, that's quick.
That's like do you remember the old Houston golf course? Did you ever play it or no?
No, I didn't play that one.
Yeah, that was, you would have loved that track, but yeah, second hole of the golf tournament, just, I was in such a bad place and I hit this, like it was a back left pin and I missed my line with a 9-iron probably like 35, 40 yards. It was just a straight block and almost missed the greenside bunker right. And the club was broken before I even knew what happened.
That's how I was too. Those damn 9-irons, those 9-irons get you.
Yeah, screw the 9-irons, man. Like, we need to carry two extra 9-irons moving forward just in case we need to break one.
Yeah, no joke. take out a 3-iron, put in 2 9-irons.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we got a little off track. That's on me. I actually just love to hear about club throwing and club breaking stories, but I see you with the municipal hat on, and that's what you were wearing on the field in Oregon this past weekend. I mean, how surreal of a moment was that, being on the field with the U.S. Open trophy?
It is so sick.
The pictures were awesome.
I've been on that field a few times, once in recruiting as like a recruit, you know, to be on the field. And then we won the Pac-12 championship and we went on the field and it was obviously really cool, but never, I mean, honestly, never thought I'd be there again, being honored after you leave school. Right. Like I didn't think I'd be honored, and to go out there and with the US Open trophy and having so many people come up to me being like, "Oh, I want to take a picture. Great going." And they're like huge fans and whatnot. That I was, you know, that was crazy. And then there was like it was a pretty loud roar. Like everyone was so pumped. I mean, I kind of blacked out for a little while. I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. This is so sick. So it was, definitely something I'll remember forever.
I mean, the pictures, the videos. I was texting with the assistant basketball coach. Shout out to Coach Kevin. He's the man up in Oregon. And I can kind of relate to this. I was a nomad in Eugene, Oregon before I went to Bannon Dunes for the US Junior. And I had a day and I just tweeted out like, "Hey, what do I do in Eugene today?" And Coach Kevin sends me back, "Hey, come watch basketball practice." I'm like, "Heck yeah, I love basketball." And met the coach, watched practice, and I was like a kind of a diehard Oregon basketball fan last year. But what an incredible place, man. Eugene's is a heck of a town.
Yeah, it's fun. It's good to go back. Like I really only go back once a year for a football game, but it's so much fun because you just go back and, as you know, I mean, you relive kind of a little bit of your college days. Mm-hmm. Eugene Country Club is such a great golf course. So I always play one round there.
I heard you shot 64 as well.
Yeah, I might have. Yeah. Yeah.
it's like you're getting ready for something.
with two three putts. I'm still friggin' pissed on that. It was my first time seeing the course since they redid it, which was fun to see.
When did they redo it?
I want to say they maybe finished like a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Okay. I guess I would have played the redo then. Because I played it last year.
Did you play last summer?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I probably was done then.
It was really good.
Did number five, you remember the par three, number five?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did it have a bunker in the front of the green, not only in the back?
Yeah, I think there was one.
Yeah. Okay. So it used to have only bunkers in the back, kind of like 13 at Augusta.
Maybe not. I don't know. I can't remember.
And then they made it more like 12 at Augusta, where it has a bunker in the front and then a one or two in the back, but like it's stuff like that would change.
Five. I'm thinking of the there's seven's a par three too, right?
Yeah,
I was thinking of that one. So five, okay. I think there were bunkers short. I do think there were.
All right, well, if there were bunkers, then it was the redo.
Yeah, well, that's a cool place, man. You got to hit fairways there. Those trees there are taller than you think. You can't really hit over them. I figured that out too.
You literally can't. I remember we used to try all the time. And it's funny when you play there, they don't seem that big. And then like you see someone out in the fairway and they just look like a little ant. And then you try to hit a driver and you try to hit it over it and you get halfway up the tree and you're like, what?
I know. Yeah, it's my like depth perception of those trees of how tall they were not a good situation. And I only had a 3-wood with me as I broke my driver at a charity event the day before. So it was a tough scene out there.
Love it.
God, just breaking clubs. And that one was on accident too. So,
Well, the accident one. Yeah.
It happened. Well, we're going to rewind back to last fall and at the CJ Cup at Congaree. And I guess this is probably the first time I'd seen you in a bit. Just kind of started working into TV last year, but that was one of the events I was working. And I went out to go watch Jordan play 9 holes, and you were playing with him that day. And you and I had a great chat. It was fun to catch up. But I remember walking away from that round thinking, man, Wyndham can be as good as he wants to be. And fast forward to where we are now, it's, you know, from where you were at Congaree to where you are now, what do you see as the biggest difference or the biggest change?
Well, that was kind of in that time when I was playing good golf and my head was still getting in the way. Mm-hmm. You know, I played awesome that week and mm-hmm. I...
Hole in one too, right?
Yeah, hole in one. And I actually broke a club that week. I broke a club that week as well. And I turned a pretty for sure top 3, 4, or 5 finish, you know, top 5 finish.
Yeah.
Into like a 15th, about as quick as you could do it just because of temper. Mm-hmm. And that's really where John, my caddy, and my agent and everyone in my team was like, all right, we got to make a change. And I agreed. I was like, I want to do something different than what we're doing, because we keep going into the week. I hit drivers good. I'm hitting irons pretty good. And one little thing seems to be off. It affects me. And then mentally, I self-deprecate. And then we feel like we should have had a great finish, if not be in contention to win. And we finish 20th or 25th, which doesn't sound bad. But when you're doing that every week where it's like, I'm topping this stat and this stat and this stat. And then basically if there was a mental stat, I was zero in that stat and I was allowing things to affect me.
Was that your entire career? Like up until this point, like, would you say you were ever at a point where you were, you know, somewhere above five or six?
Yeah, for sure. I think some of the tournaments I even won in college, I was always on the edge of boiling point to just break and have my, really get mad. And I think that's why I didn't win early on in my career. I've had a bunch of chances. I've been in contention a lot. I just would get into pressure moments and would have a lot of anxiety. And then the anxiety would lead to me being so frustrated that I had the anxiety. And then I would, blow up and then self-sabotage. So we made a decision to really focus on my mental game and hire somebody and go through that route. And I basically challenged myself to give myself 6 months of all in on that and see where we're at. And what's crazy to think is 6 months in pretty much was right at the US Open or just after the US Open. So in 6 months, we won twice. We moved up 100 some spots in the world. We only missed one cut in those 6 months, stuff like that, to where it was, we ended up having 10 top tens or whatever it was. So it was pretty amazing that we made that big of a jump and had success right away.
In those 6 months, what was the most important thing that you learned about yourself?
Probably the biggest thing was my self-talk. It's amazing. Like, people probably knowing me playing on the golf course would be like, oh, your self-talk's terrible. And I probably deep down knew, I did know that it wasn't good. But what I didn't believe was that if I changed that self-talk and actually had good self-talk, what that effect could really do. And it was hard. I mean, there were still tournaments I finished well or had top finishes and I was trending in the right direction. But one or two of the days I was really getting negative. And, to change your self-talk, you can't just do it overnight. And it took a while. And it's amazing how this year has progressed. Like, you could just see it. I was starting to play better on Thursdays and Fridays and then having tough Saturdays and Sundays. And then I started having better Saturdays. And then, I was just like literally progressing, making cuts, top finish here and there. And all of it, I think, has to do a lot with the self-talk towards myself and the belief in that. And so as I got better and better with that, I started playing better and better. And then, I tell people this, the biggest putt of my career probably was the made putt on Friday in Mexico, the week before Quail Hollow. I made a 15 footer on 18 to make the cut by one. Wow. I went on that weekend and really used that as prep for the next week. I figured out a lot of things, felt really confident going into it with my putting, and I would have never done that before. So I gained momentum there and I went into Quail going, hey, I'm hitting it great. I started making putts on the weekend. I felt confident. And then I win my first tour event. And then everything else just started falling into place. And it's amazing how something small like that, but for me, it was huge because I would have thrown in the towel that round well before that. I was playing good in Mexico, just was not making birdies. And I grinded out a birdie on the last hole. And it was, and then I just kept playing great golf after that. So,
yeah, I'm sitting here kind of looking at your results in this 2022-2023 season. I can understand why you're, just why you believe that you should should win and playing up to that standard. And I'm sitting here looking, you know, you finished fifth at Valspar, sixth and at Punta Cana, then you finished third in New Orleans. And then the T24 at Mexico, like you're talking about, shoot 69 on Saturday, 65 on the weekend. And then we get to Wells Fargo, like you're talking about. And I'm curious about the self-talk that you gave yourself going into that weekend round on Saturday. You and Xander Schauffele probably had two of the best rounds of the year playing in the same group together on that Saturday at Quail Hollow. I mean, what was that round like? I mean, it's easy when things are going good. And I guess you can answer as well into Sunday, kind of how you're able to manage your emotions on the weekend.
You know, I think this is one of those tournaments similar to maybe like Phil and Henrik Stenson at that Open that one year.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think of some other ones where I don't think we would have been as far ahead of the field if I wasn't there and if he wasn't there. I think the person only wins by one or two, you know, to the field, and we end up beating the field. I would beat the field by 8 or 9, and he beat the field by 4. And so we kind of just fed off each other. I remember teeing off on Saturday. Obviously, I think at that time we were tied, or I was one shot or off the lead or one ahead of the lead. I forget exactly where we started on Saturday, but I just remember we both were playing so good. And every time he birdied, I either birdied the same hole or I'd birdie the next hole. And it was just like a birdie fest. And what's crazy is, as you know, that golf course is so flipping hard.
Oh, I know.
And no one else was doing what we were doing. I mean, we were shooting 5, 6, 7, 8 unders, and everyone else is grinding out 1 or 2 under. So we fed off of each other, for sure on Saturday. And then the same thing Sunday. Let's say Xander wasn't in the picture and I had a 6-7 shot lead, that would have been really tough for me for my first win. Basically knowing all I can't do is screw up, right? And that's really hard to play golf that way. You know, I would like to think now, as I've matured as a player and gotten better mentally, that I could really handle that. But at the time, I think that would have been hard. And it was so good because I bogeyed the first hole, and then Xander ended up birdieing like the fourth hole. And just like that, I lost my lead.
Right.
And, you know, and then he birdies another hole and now I'm down one. And so it's like, okay, well, now we got to actually grind and play. And it was the best thing for me, because then I birdied hole 8. And then from then on, I played really, really good golf. So I really do owe a lot to Xander. Obviously, he's pissed he didn't win, but he really helped me with my first win, because he kind of kept the pedal and the pressure on me. And so it made me have to continue to play really hard.
Yeah. And then, I mean, you get to the US Open, and this one was a little different in the fact that I felt like you were still under the radar, but I didn't ever sense from you that you felt like you couldn't win the tournament based on what you were saying in the press conferences. You know, I think a lot of people were pointing towards, can Ricky Fowler win? Can Rory McIlroy come back and win? And did that make it easier for you, knowing that you just didn't have that pressure? Or, well, I know you probably felt the pressure, but you know what I mean?
It more pissed me off than anything.
Right.
Because I just won, you know, whatever that was, 5 weeks prior in against the same field, mm-hmm. on a very tough golf course. And so they were just discrediting me. Like, everyone was saying, oh, Rory's right there, he could win. And you got Scottie Scheffler and obviously Ricky. And then they're like, oh, you know, and, you know, Wyndham's there, but they basically just wrote me off. And it, not that I watched the press conferences, but I could feel it amongst the fans. And even after rounds, I was hardly getting any, you know, after the first round, no one did any interviews. And then after the second round, they did like a quick interview. And then even after the third round, going in the final day, Ricky got all the stuff. And so I was just like, I could just feel it. They're like, they don't think I'm going to win, and they don't want me to win. So if anything, it gave me a chip on my shoulder. And every time someone yelled Ricky's name, I reminded myself of the goals I had that day and how good I was. And so, which was a lot, by the way. I mean, I love Ricky, and obviously the California crowd wanted Ricky, and there's probably 500,000+, you know, go Ricky's, and always wanting Ricky. And there weren't many for me. And I just, every time I heard it, I reminded myself that I can do this. I can do this. And so it was just a constant reminder that I can go and win. And so, yeah, I never once thought that I couldn't do it. I mean, I there was kind of a piece about me that week that I felt like, hey, I'm just as good as these guys. I just beat these guys a few weeks ago. And why can't I do it here?
I didn't write you off. I'm going to tell you that.
Yeah,
right
well, thanks, Miley.
Hey, but I picked up your group that day on the eighth hole and walked with you all the way to the finish. And the eighth hole was actually kind of a wild one. And the fact that you actually made a very nice bogey there, things kind of were slipping away, it felt like. But then missing the green at nine, you get a great up and down. And I think you parred 10. Is that right? Because I'm about to get to 11.
I actually missed like a 15-footer for birdie. Hit a decent shot in there.
That's right. That's right. And we get to 11, and we know how hard that hole is. Like 250 yards down the hill, that back pin. Ricky hits an incredible four iron. And at that point, Ricky was kind of just trying to creep his way back into the golf tournament. Comes up just short into that bunker. And then you try to hit something up on that left side and just pulled it, hit it a little too hard. Goes down the slope, pin high. And the entire week, I was watching guys hit shots from down there, and hardly anybody was getting up and down. And most importantly, what I kept seeing was guys were trying to bump that shot. And you came up to me right as you were getting up to the hill. You didn't know where your golf ball was. And you said, hey, where's my ball? I said, like, pin high. And I tried to keep as mellow of an answer as I could, because I didn't want to like give you any negativity or any positivity that it was a good situation, because it wasn't. I mean, I really felt like five was in play. I didn't feel like an up and down was really an option. But dude, that was one of the best shots I've ever seen. And I don't know. I don't think people realize how good that up and down was.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to toot my horn. I don't want anyone to think this in this, in this podcast. But the up and downs I had that week and some of the shots I hit, I mean, there's tournaments people win, and it's, you know, you maybe think of like one or two big shots. Like I go back to Quail Hollow and it's like, okay, I hit maybe a couple good iron shots and maybe made a couple good putts. But like, you know, it's like, that's pretty standard. I made a 25 footer or I hit an 8 iron to, you know, 5 feet. Like, yeah, okay, that's a good shot. But I hit some shots that week that were I mean, like the one on 9, I mean, up and downs on 8, 9 and then getting to 11. I mean, the green was 25 feet above me. You barely see the top of the flag, and it slopes away, and I'm on baked out grass that people have been walking on. And I remember I got there and I was like, I just knew in my mind, I was like, I can hit the shot. And I said, if anything, air long, and we can try to, you know, we'll try to make a putt. And right off the face, it was one of those literally where it just, I clipped it perfect. And in the air, like in my mind, I was like, oh, I might've made this, because it, when you talk about visualizing the shot and exactly what you want, I did exactly what I wanted. And when it bounced straight, I was like, oh my God, that could go in. And so it was one of those where I couldn't run up there. So I kind of hit it, saw it land, and then I was just waiting to hear it. Cause I was like, there could be a roar if this happens. And it didn't. And I got up there and I still had about a 5-6 footer, and making that was, I mean, massive momentum.
And Ricky missed it too.
You know, I think it was bad momentum for Ricky, cause he's like, man, this guy's not making any mistakes. And the other guys, and then huge momentum for me. It was like, all right, let's just get our, all right, we've done our crazy shots. Let's just keep it going. So that was definitely sick. One of the best up and downs of my life, for sure.
It was so sick. And then, dude, you pulled driver out on the next hole, which I thought was so smart. I mean, I've seen guys hit irons all week. I'm like, I just loved driver there that week. And I was surprised that more people didn't do it, and you split the fairway.
Yeah. I wasn't hitting it. I was not hitting my irons good that week. I go to Quail Hollow. Everything was clicking. I was pounding driver. I was hitting irons great. I was putting great. I was chipping great. And at the US Open, I was putting good. I was chipping good. And I was hitting driver good. But everything in between, I had two-way misses. I didn't have control of the ball. And so you come to that hole, I'm a fader. And that week I was hitting a big fade. And I did not feel comfortable trying to hit a straight to tight draw. And so we got to that hole every day and I was like, John, what do you think? And he's like, well, where's your comfort level? Do you feel like you can hit the shot? And I go, yeah, I literally don't feel comfortable trying to hit a straight ball or a draw. And so I said, I guess the play is to just hit it up and over and hit a cut into the fairway. And it was the widest area. So if you hit it up there, it's the widest area. Sure, you're getting closer and it's kind of a tough shot, but you know, I pulled it off 3 of the 4 days. I birdied it one or two of the days. And I feel like that was definitely a big hole in the tournament. Cause as you said, so many guys were trying to hit it in the correct spot and then they'd have 130 yards and they'd make a mess of it and hit it in the bunker or long and whatever. So.
No, it was, I loved that decision. And I mean, just to make a note, where does that 3-wood on, was it 14, the 14th hole? Where does that one stack up? Is that one up in the Hall of Fame for you?
John thinks John afterwards was like, he said that was one of the greatest shots in US Open history. And he said, under the circumstance, you know, you have one of the best players in the world tap right there, knocking on the door. And it's the par five, that hole is very challenging. Like, yes, it's par five, but you could easily walk away with a bogey or double just like that. One bad shot and you're in a terrible spot and you don't know what to do. And then I guess only one person, or I was the only person, hit the green that day. And that area that I landed in
so tight, was like dude.
8 yards. And I mean, I look back at it and I'm like, holy crap, I can't believe I even did that. And basically, a couple of people said, like talk show people or news, reporters, they said if you made the putt, it probably would be in one of the top shots ever in the US Open. But unfortunately, I missed the putt. So,
I mean, I was sitting there watching with my eyes, and it happened within, you know, the up and down on 11, that flop shot, and the 3-wood on 14. I just was dumbfounded watching it in person. I said, what did I just watch and what did I just witness? Was that two of the best shots I've ever seen in any circumstance? And then that Sunday of the US Open, it just was insane. And then you kind of mentioned the wide fairway, or it was wider up on the 12th fairway. How happy were you that the 18th hole happened to be a runway, if you will, for your driver?
Oh my gosh. I mean, yeah. I mean, that's like the biggest, that's the biggest sigh of relief. So I was leading after I bogeyed 16, and really all day, I was concerned about 17's tee shot.
It's dicey.
I was thinking about 17 because I was like, okay, if we had a 2 or 3 shot lead, I was going way left. And that in my mind, I was like, we're just going to go way left and we're going to punt.
Like on two, like towards two? You were just going to bomb over on two.
Because I was like, let's just basically eliminate any big number. Cause if you try to hit the fairway and block it right, you bring in the hazard and who knows. So, but then when we get to the situation where I didn't really think about this, I was like, well, now we have a 1-shot lead. We need to make par or birdie, and going left kind of eliminates the birdie. So, you know, hitting that tee shot was huge. And then as we were walking up to 18, all I was listening for was a roar because I knew Rory was ahead of me. And so if I heard a roar, I knew, all right, I got a birdie 18. Cause we didn't, from the tee box to 18, there was no scoreboard. So I wouldn't have known if he birdied or not other than a roar. And all I heard was sighs. And so I go, all right, I have to par to basically, you know, win this tournament. And so it's funny. That was the most nervous tee ball I had all day, even though it's the easiest tee shot. And I think it's one of those things because it was so wide open that it's like similar kind of thing. Like all I could do is screw up. And so what I did is I said, okay, I've been in this situation in my career multiple times, not to win a tournament, but in the situation where like, you know, to make a cut or to, you know, or to win a tournament or to have a top finish. And you get to an easy hole, and sometimes it's hard. Like it's an easy hole and you almost don't focus.
Yeah.
And so what I did is I said, let's just shape the ball and hit the shot that I know where the ball's going to go. I didn't want to aim down the fairway and have a pull hook or a huge slice. And so I said, all right, I'm going to aim left and I'm going to literally slice it. And just, I have a runway. And obviously everyone talks about how much that sliced and how gross it was, but
you hit it right over my head. You were aimed right at me. I'm like, wow, he's aimed left.
Yeah. I was right on the rope line. Yeah. John told me, he goes, Dub, just trust. He goes, trust it and hit a big cut. And I was like, all right. And so I aimed left and just hit that. And, you know, I was nervous because it was, as you know, as a player, it's hitting into the sun is so tough.
Right. And that's a good point.
We were looking right into the sun. So you hit it and you don't see it. And you're like, you know, obviously in that moment, all I care about is where the ball's going. And so I kind of was in this panic mode. I was like, where'd it go? Where'd it go? I felt like I hit it a little farther right than I wanted. And fortunately, Ricky's caddy, Ricky, he goes, it's on the last, it landed on the last flag. And so then I looked up and I go, oh, fairway. We're good. That's it's in the fairway. So, yeah, it was definitely nice having a runway at the end though.
I mean, but were you surprised at all? So you were kind of talking about how difficult it was to hit into the sun. But one of the things I noticed, so we get up to the fairway and we couldn't see a thing for about like 5 minutes. And then right before you hit, it's like the sun went down. Like you could finally like see the flag stick. It was like one of the eeriest things, because I don't know if you noticed it, but I did. And I was thinking,
I didn't notice.
Well, it was weird because I couldn't find the flag stick when I got up there, when I got the numbers. And then when you were about to hit, I could finally see everything again. It was, I don't know. I was curious to see if you would actually notice that, but were you surprised when it came off the iron that it was heading right at the flag stick? Cause you were kind of talking about how your iron game was a little suspect during the week. Was that at all of a shock to you that you striped one?
Well, I stripe is a loose term there. So
online,
I clanked it online. It was a perfect chip cut six iron. I mean, yeah. If it was Friday, even Saturday, you know, in any other situation, I'm aiming about 15 yards left. I'm hitting a chip cut six iron. It lands, you know, 5-10 paces short, releases up there. But we knew two things. We knew we couldn't go long. And under that situation, you know, you're probably amped up, whatever, and couldn't go long. And then we knew I wasn't hitting my iron fit. So John, I said, you know, what do you think? Is it chip cut six? And he goes, no, it's a full seven iron all day. And I go, really? He goes, yep, you're going to get it there too. And he, you know, I come to find out later that no way I was getting it there. He just said that so that I wasn't going to try to swing out of my shoes.
What great caddying there, right?
Yeah. Well, because basically he thought, he goes, all right, if he pulls it or flares it or chunks it or whatever, if it's short, even if it goes in the bunker, he's going to get it out and have within, let's say, 10 feet to try to win the U.S. Open. And that's probably where his mind was. The only thing you really couldn't do is have a huge miss or go long. Because then you now really couldn't get it close. And so he just knew. He knew I wasn't hitting it good. And he's like, we're just hitting seven iron. So it was awesome that it was right at the flag. But I knew off the face, I was like, that is not getting there. And, you know, having to two putt from about 50, 60 feet to win the U.S. Open.
You made it easy though, right?
I know. But still, I look back at it, it's like, you know, your worst nightmare. You wish you just hit it to 15 feet and you could two putt and get the hell out of there. But
I've always wanted to have that moment on the 18th green, like over a long putt like that 50, 60 footer. What was going through your mind during that moment? Were you thinking about, you know, winning the U.S. Open, or were you like just kind of like oddly calm because it's so quiet? You know, there's thousands of people around you. Were you still able to stay right there in that moment?
Yeah, it is crazy when you, what I've noticed, the two tournaments I won is you almost don't. You almost don't know about anything else. Like you're just so focused on the golf. And sure, maybe your mind wanders in some of the walks, but when you get to hit, it's like you bring yourself back to like, all right, all I have to, you know, you get so focused on your process and what you're doing
right,
that over that putt, all I kept reminding myself was, hey, on lag putts uphill, I tend to leave them short. And I just remind myself, I said, hey, make sure we, you know, just hit the putt, make sure you hit it harder than you think. And I was so zoned in. Like I had the read, everything. Like it was nothing. I mean, as I look back and think about it, there was no, at the moment and when I was hitting, there was nothing like, hey, two putt to win the Open, or I'm going to win the U.S. Open. It was like, no, I'm focused on this putt. Wow. Now, once the putt stopped, all that went out the window because now I knew I won the U.S. Open and I had a, you know, 8-inch putt, 6-inch putt. And I'm just like, I wanted to cry. I had so many nerves. Like at that point I was freaking out. So all that left right after that putt stopped, all that went out the window.
It's the coolest thing in the world, man, because that basically what it did, you obviously win the U.S. Open, which is the best, but it, you know, it got you, you know, in a great spot to automatically qualify for the Ryder Cup. And if I would have told you back at Congaree at the CJ Cup, where we're walking in that practice round, said, "Hey, Wyndham, not only are you going to make the Ryder Cup, but you're going to make it as an automatic qualifier," what would you have believed me if I would have told you that?
I mean, realistically, no. I mean, no, I wasn't even on my radar. I didn't even, at the beginning of the year, I wasn't like, "Oh, it's Ryder Cup year." Of course, I wanted to make the team, but you know, I'm concerned about keeping my card, trying to get my first win, you know, all that stuff. So,
man, it's crazy how fast in this game you can get confidence and you play yourself into events like this. Like, as you're going to be doing it, Marco Simone, and I know you guys just got back from a scouting trip, if you will. You know, what was your overall impressions of the golf course that y'all going to be playing?
I didn't hear good things about it going into it. A lot of people were like, "Oh, I don't know why you're playing there." And so honestly, my expectations were really low going there. And I was a little bummed, to be honest, because I was like, "Oh, that's a bummer to play the Ryder Cup. And yeah, you know, people don't like the course." But then when I got there, I couldn't disagree more with what a lot of people said. I really do think it's a good track. It reminds me a little bit of Napa's golf course in the sense that you feel like you're in the same topography. Like, there's the kind of the hills with the yellow kind of dried out grass, and there's wineries and stuff. So it's really pretty. Now the golf course is not quite like that, but the topography is like that. And then the golf course is a big boy course. I mean, if it was a regular tour event, I would probably play there every year because it's a bomber's paradise. Now, with the setup, they do not have it set up that way. Everything at about 310, 300 to 320 really narrows in, and the rough's really thick. Yeah, but so like my first impression was I liked it a lot more than what people said. And, you know, I think it's going to be a really good test to golf. It is going to be interesting how they set it up, though.
The team room vibe, I think, is going to be fantastic. I think a lot of guys are pretty close with each other. And we know Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay, pretty much we can pencil those guys in together, as well as JT and Jordan. Is there anybody that you're kind of campaigning for to play with, or are you just happy to play with whoever Zach put you with?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to play with anyone. I'm just happy to be on the team. You know, being my first Ryder Cup, it's going to be obviously amazing experience, and I can't wait for that. But I'm friends with almost all the guys, and that trip to Rome really, I feel like, made me feel even more comfortable being on the team, and enjoyed all the guys so much more than I ever maybe would have thought. And certain guys that I was like, "Oh, I don't know about this guy," and then ended up being, "Oh, that guy's amazing." And so with that said, leaving that practice round, it's like they could pair me with whoever and I would enjoy it. So, you know, I'm friends with most of the guys anyways. And that's, like you said, our camaraderie is already great because a lot of us are within the same age and we've played a ton of practice rounds. We grew up playing college golf and junior golf together. So we all have known each other for a long time. So it's pretty fun to look back at that and be like, "Wow, we've come a long way since junior golf and we're all playing in the Ryder Cup together." So it's cool.
Well, you're damn right. And I mean, you're a basketball player just like myself. And I know you're probably looking forward to the away game as well.
Yeah, sure. I would love my first one to be at home, and I'd love to make the putt on whatever hole to win the Ryder Cup and just have it be pandemonium. But there's honestly nothing better than shutting up a gym and coming in and everyone walking out with their head down and tail between their legs going, and you're just like, you know, as big as you can be. So that's
peacocking.
Yeah. So I love it.
All right, man. Well, that's it from us. I know, I guess if I could offer one suggestion is, you know, Daniel Berger and Justin Thomas at Whistling Straits at the last Ryder Cup, they weren't playing that afternoon match, but they got on the tee and they basically shotgun some beers, or not shotgun, but they were chugging them and threw them down. Maybe like this is how you become friendly with the European crowd or the Italians, is maybe just pour yourself a nice red wine and just walk around with some spaghetti and meatballs. And that'll be how you they're like, "This Wyndham Clark guy, he knows how to wine and dine. We're going to cheer for him." So
maybe I'll light up a stogie too and have a glass of wine and just walk around and swirl.
That could be you. I'm just, I don't know. Maybe a little mustache or something you can just throw on just for the day.
Yeah.
Hey, Just an idea. Just an idea. Well,
I'm looking forward to run that through the ranks.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there'll be a lot of drinking regardless of the end of the Ryder Cup, and look forward to watching you, man. I've been very impressed, and you know, you're just such an incredible talent, but really cool to see you make the jump this year, and it's been really fun to watch.
Yeah, well, appreciate you, buddy. It's fun being
Thanks,
on here.
Thanks, brother.
Really enjoyed the chat with Wyndham, and looking forward to seeing who he plays with in Rome. If he breaks out a cigar and some wine on the first tee. We have some big things in store for you next week. On Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll be dropping a two-part collab with European Tour winner Beef Johnston of the Beef's Golf Club podcast previewing the Ryder Cup. And we'll have a special guest, former Team Europe captain, Padraig Harrington. So go subscribe to his feed and ours, and be on the lookout for the next week to get you ready for the Ryder Cup. Thanks for listening. We'll see you then. The Smiley Show is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please give a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe today wherever you stream your podcast.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.